7. This is the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. Today we have a public hearing on House Bill 5019, which is the Oregon Department of Education. And before we start, and I lay out some ground rules and some suggestions, I'm going to turn it over to Legislative Fiscal Analyst Steve Bender, who has some information for the committee members. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let you know that we have distributed to you today a three-week schedule for the material, subcommittee's work for the next 3 weeks. If you notice, it's in calendar form. These 3 weeks will be taken up. The next 2 weeks will be on school funding, K-12 school funding, and then the week of April 9th will be community college funding. There are a couple of exceptions, though, I'd like to point out to you now. You will note that next Thursday, the 29th of March, you are having a site visit to Portland Community College, and this meeting will begin at 4 p.m. with a tour and continue until 7 p.m. We will have additional information for you next week with some more details about this meeting, but it will be focusing on community colleges and their partnerships with K-12 as well as other education issues in general. Some of you will note behind the calendar there will be another item, which will be a copy of an email that we sent to your offices last week requesting a response from you. We would like to hear back from you whether you will need a ride or whether you'll be taking your own transportation so we could arrange that. Otherwise, just note there's some public testimony days that are shown here on the calendar. If you have any questions about the calendar, please let me know.
Senator,
there's no parking passes required.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that, Senator. In this case, there are no parking passes required. There's no issue with the value of the parking passes. Okay. But we still would like to know, because we need to reserve the van and know how many people want to drive up with us. We do have transportation available for any member who would like
it. Just as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, reference was made by the co-chair, I think Senator Schrader, this morning with respect to a June 15 date. And I'm wondering what date we're working back from to wrap up all of the ways and means. So to the extent that you know where the critical decision dates are on this calendar, for wherever that end date is and then back would be appreciated. So we know kind of the game plan. What quarter we're in, I guess.
That's how many timeouts do we have left?
Right.
And all that.
Yeah.
Okay. And I would on the community college visit, I believe that's spring break.
Yes,
that is spring break, so we don't need parking passes. And the chair is particularly sensitive to people sort of making it to this hearing. So if you want your input to be taken. No, I'm just kidding. No, we really appreciate people who show up. So it's not for the people actually sitting on the dais now. It's for the people who aren't here yet. So hope they're paying attention. So,
Mr. Chair, would it be possible for the committee members to get the overall schedule of the committee to the end of the session? I know that it's often a work in process, but if we could have a more global look at the schedule than just, a few weeks at a time, I think it would be helpful to
us. I will do that.
Thank you.
We can do that. Any other queries? You're right. It does seem to...
It's kind of chunky.
I know, and it changes a lot, too. So, all right. With that, thank you, Mr. Bender. So today, as you can see, we have quite a large number of people. So what we're going to do is... just a couple of things to keep in mind. Everybody here would like the opportunity to speak, and the only way that that's possible is if people are concise, brief, and to the point, and preferably 3 minutes maximum. 3 minutes. And it goes by very quickly, 3 minutes. And I know it doesn't seem like a lot of time, but we have a lot of people. And so that's just what we need to do. So to the extent that you can be observant of those guidelines, the committee will benefit, and people who want to testify will benefit, and we really appreciate that. I believe there's also
an opportunity on Monday? There's not. Okay. So...
You can have one later if you choose.
Okay. We're hoping on that. So, trying to keep you 3 minutes. Also, if you have written testimony, that's fantastic. If you have written testimony, I would urge you not to come up and then just read it verbatim, word for word, and we're looking at the top of your head. Talk to us. We will collect the written testimony. We can read it later, and it's more effective, and we'll have a better conversation if you just will just talk to us and you know, use your text as a guideline, but just reading it is you know, not necessarily as effective. So, but that's ultimately, it's up to you. I'm just some suggestions. So first, I'm going to call people up, and I think we have three or so chairs. Probably going to call up people in groups, and you might not necessarily be in a group with that, with those other people, but I'm just going to call you up, and then I'm going to say, kind of on deck, who's next. So the first folks I'm going to call up are Julie Young, Chuck Bennett, and James Sager. And then following that, babies always take precedence. So we've got, and I mean that literally, not figuratively. So John Olson?
Marty Olson.
What's the...
My nickname is Marty.
Marty, okay. Mr. Olson. Who's that? No, that's... We have inaccurate info. I don't see a child there. Who has a child? What is...
My name is Valerie
Close. Olson. Okay, we'll find it. You get priority. First, you get to go first class.
Right now?
We're all in coach. Well, you'll be next. Okay. You'll be next. So.
My name is Julie Young. I'm Executive Director of Chess for Success, and I want to thank you for meeting with us previously about our program. And in the interest of time, I put together a one-page summary of the key points we talked about when we met with you. And I'm here to answer any questions if you have them.
And we'll quickly move through so we can get our 3 minutes collectively. James Sager with the Governor's Office. I'm here to, on behalf of the Governor, speak in favor of the Chess for Success piece, because he discovered by visiting the site, looking at the program, what a wonderful program it is. My background is I have... having taught the material back when I was teaching elementary school and seeing the success firsthand of children, it's going to be important for you to read the material, because I think this is the one program that doesn't cost us very much money, but the research is very clear that it actually helps students, without realizing they're learning study skills, gain those real skills, not only for academic studies, but for life experiences. So, again, thank you, and we can answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We're also here to support the Chess for Success program. Mr. Chairman, I had a chance to talk to a number of school administrators that have this program in their schools, primarily in the metropolitan area. One stuck with me. It was at Mewberry Elementary in Hillsborough School District. The principal, Paul Goodheim, described a family involvement component to this that he said is remarkable. And what we're very excited about is the possibility with this small state involvement in the program to take it statewide outside of the metropolitan area in Monmouth and go into eastern Oregon, into rural areas. This is a remarkable program that has all of the impacts, I'm told, by administrators that's described by Ms. Young in her written information. So, thank you.
Are there any questions, Representative?
I've got a question at the LFO. Darren, bearing in mind that the co-chair's budget is just a guideline, do you know to what extent Chess for Success is included or not included in the budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I do not believe it was included.
Oversight.
All right, on that happy note,
we'll work on it.
Yes, it's the start of a conversation, and appreciate testimony coming today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mary Ann and Jay Coulson.
Wes, Washington County.
Oh.
And then. Okay. So will you be next? Will that be work? Will that work? And then we'll go to the folks who are here who are from more than 100 miles. We have some people. And I forgot to say one thing is when you first come up, if you, you know, for the record, introduce yourself, just say your name and if you want, where you're from.
My name is Jay Colson. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon.
I'm Marianne Colson. This is Sophia.
This is Sophia. Mr. Chair, committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. We're here, as you can probably... It's funny at work, I'm the rough one. As you can probably guess, because of our daughter, Sophia, she's 19 months old. When Sophia was first born, within a day, we started learning new terms like head lag, hypotonia, muscle laxity, and we realized very quickly that as much of a joy as she is, that we were going to be in a situation where we weren't going to be experiencing a normal childhood with her. After the first few months, Sophia was not progressing developmentally. We were learning that not only was her development in question, but her actual survival. And we went through a very rigorous process of trying to understand what was going on with Sophia. To this day, we actually don't know what's at the cause of her developmental delay. The one thing that we can say is that from those early months of where we were literally concerned over whether or not we were going to be able to keep our daughter, she's progressed quite well. She's closed the developmental gap to a large degree, and we're extremely hopeful for the future that Sophia has. The reason that we're here and feel so strongly about being here is that we attribute a lot of her well-being and our ability to care for her
due to the services she's received through Northwest Regional ESD Early Intervention Services. Sophia also does get some private physical therapy as well, but with the home visits she gets through early intervention as well as the on-site visits, there are things there that they've been able to do for her that we've not received through our other care. And without some of the services that we've received, that we know she won't be as far along as she is. So that's right. Basically...
So, and the last thing we really want to say is we've been fortunate to have the ability to access resources for Sophia, but one of the things this has helped us realize so greatly that we never would have known living the life we were before she arrived is the number of people where early intervention is the absolutely only net they've got. And we think very much about them as we've had our experience with Sophia as well.
Representative Morgan.
Make a comment.
Sure.
Thank you for coming here. I know this takes a great deal of courage for you to come forward and tell us what you're trying to deal with. But thank you for doing that, and thank you for the obvious love that you have for your daughter. And, Mr. Chair, the Early Childhood Intervention Program is something that is important no matter where you are in the state. In the rural areas, it's very often the only access that people have to the training and the skills that the children and the parents need to be able to maximize the potential of the children. And I'm hoping that as we move forward here, we'll deal with some problems that are in the budget with this agency and with the ability of the agency to deal with the increasing numbers of children that are needing this kind of care.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Well, thank you very much. I think Representative Morgan articulated public thoughts of all of us, and really appreciate you coming down. And we wish you the best of luck, and hope we can do a goodbye to your family. Thank
and we
you.
We have written testimonies right
now. Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Val, is it close? Close. Val Close, and I see Amanda, Robin.
Sure.
And then I can't read the... all the names. I'm sorry.
And then we have one more member who's speaking this one. We have an extra chair. Hello, I'm Valerie Close. I'm the co-director of EC Cares, which is the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program in Lane County. And I'm going to give you a brief overview, the nuts and bolts of early intervention, early childhood special ed, and then turn to the parents on this panel to fill you in with some more of the personal details and how this affects them. I'm going to be using some specific examples from Lane County, but I want you to hear clearly that these programs exist in every county, in every region in Oregon. You're getting a packet, and on the first page you'll see a map that shows the different regions. And I'm going to be going over some of the information there, but to save time, I'm just going to hit it very briefly. Early intervention, early childhood special ed, is special education for children from birth up to school age, for those children who have developmental delays and disabilities. The services have been mandated in federal law since 1986, and here in Oregon since 1992. As of March 1st, there are over 9,000 children receiving these services in the state of Oregon, over 9,000. And if you look on page 2 and 3 of your packet, you can see how many children in your regions are receiving these services. To set the context for why this is important, you all know that 90% of a child's brain growth happens in the first 3 years of life. It's essential that we work with young kids as early as possible. Second, national economists have shown that for every dollar spent on young children, $4 to $17 are saved over the course of that child's lifetime. And so it's essential that we begin early on. Children qualify for this program if they have a specific diagnosis like autism, cerebral palsy, a genetic disorder like Down syndrome, or if they have a significant delay in one or more area, so mobility, communication, cognitive processing. The services are based individually on the child's needs, but in general, for babies, our goal is to teach parents what to do. A teacher makes a home visit and shows parents how to help their babies learn to talk, to walk, to feed themselves, to play with toys. So children like Doug Bailey or like Sophie Eager receive home visits from a licensed teacher. When children are preschool age, 3 to 5 years old, our goal is to provide enhanced preschool services or speech therapy so those kids really enter kindergarten ready to learn. Employees of these programs or the staff are licensed, qualified staff, just like in public school system, except that they're licensed to work with young children. They're speech therapists, occupational physical therapists, teachers, autism specialists, but they're working with these young children. We alluded to growth a minute ago. I think Representative Morgan alluded to growth. We are experiencing about 5% growth in these programs every year, and this last year was no exception. Some of your regions, I notice, are growing even faster than that. To illustrate it on a personal level, 10 years ago in my program in Lane County, we had fewer than 600 children in the program. This year, at this time, we have over 1,200. So it's putting a tremendous stress on these programs as we grow. Slide 17 in your handout will show those figures for the state of Oregon. It's a pretty steady upward curve. Not only are we serving more children, but there's an increase in the intensity of the needs of these children. I've been doing this work for over 30 years, and I've seen tremendous changes in the kinds of needs that kids come with. For example, in Lane County, half of the children in our program are living below the poverty line. About 13% of the children in our program right now are in foster care. That means that they've experienced abuse and neglect. You've all heard about the rising numbers of children with autism. We're living proof. 8 to 10% of the children in our program now have autism. And finally, we have seen a tremendous increase in the number of children who have been exposed to drugs and alcohol. So funding, briefly, about a third of the funding comes from the federal government, and about two-thirds of it comes from the state general fund, from the state education grant and aid. We stretch our resources by collaborating with public health nurses, Head Start, DHS Child Protection, relief nurseries, to really maximize what we do best. Your packet has many outcomes in there, but I want to emphasize just one page, two of these outcomes. In our program, this has been fairly consistent over the last few years, about 20% of the children leave our program no longer needing special education services. And that's a fantastic number. The other children, of those other children who go into kindergarten needing special ed, 100% of them enter that kindergarten door with educational plans in place. They have goals, they have objectives. Teachers know who they are, teachers know what they need to learn. And I think those are two of the most outstanding outcomes. If you have questions about specific programs, I think you have contact numbers in your packet there. And we'd be happy to answer them. These programs make sense because they financially make sense. They save the state of Oregon thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars over the course of a child's lifetime. But in addition, they make a significant difference to the health and well-being of family and children. And I think that's what the other members of this panel are going to share with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Close.
Hi. My name is Amanda Cheka, and I'm the mother of the two beautiful children no one can hear over. My son, Austin, is, and that's my husband, Garrett Cheka. He's wonderful. My son, Austin, is 4, and he was recently diagnosed with autism. And my daughter, Bailey, is 2.5, and she has a chromosome disorder called 1Q36 deletion syndrome. It's somewhat complicated because they are two very different afflictions that they have to deal with, but at the same time, Bailey's chromosome disorder mirrors autism in many ways. I think it's just kind of luck of the draw the way that worked out. We had Austin's chromosomes tested, and he does not suffer from the same thing Bailey has. So, there are many, many different areas that both of my children are covered through services through EC Cares, and I can't describe how much of a difference it's made in our family to really get to know these people and have these people get to know our children. It's really hard when you have two children with disabilities because a lot of people see you for the fits that they can throw, and they don't really understand their children. So to have people who truly, truly understand your children and can see past the fits and what have you to see that there's something behind it and don't see your child as a bad child is huge. It's one thing for me not to be understood, but to have my children struggle with it is sometimes difficult, always difficult. It's hard for me to describe how important these people are in our lives because they've given us the tools for our family to thrive. They've given us the tools to know what to do to help my son go into public places and not be so overstimulated, and to understand why he's getting overstimulated. They've given us the help that we've needed to help Bailey with some of the issues that she has medically. We received both of their medical diagnoses about 6 weeks apart from each other. So I'm not sure if it's because we didn't really want to admit what we were seeing with our children or because we didn't know what to look for that we were so surprised by these diagnoses. But it was a huge impact. My husband and I both believe, however, that it's a lot easier to rejoice in our children's abilities versus their disabilities. And every service that they receive through EC Cares only pushes them to do better and be able to strive for better things. And that's the ultimate goal. We want our children to be the best people they can be. And we love them regardless of what they can or can't do. But having said that, these services are immeasurable in their importance in our life. So thank you so much for coming to listen to the issues that are so important to so many families.
Well, thank you very much. It's greatly appreciated. Your children have wonderful parents. So we can't replace that. So we do appreciate it.
Thank
you very much. Any questions or comments? Thank you.
My name is Hughes Ronan Sato. This is my son Raven. He's almost 5. He'll be 5 in April. I was diagnosed with autism at the age of 2.5 years old. right now we live in Beaverton, but we were born in Florida, and we lived in California when he was visiting his servicing, when he got his diagnosis. And I want to state that they were aggressive in trying to help us out at that point. We were just going to get diagnosis. We were giving about 15 hours worth of services a week. And actually, I'm surprised he's seeing that group right now, because I'm so sure that he's got better. At first, he was not making eye contact with the adults, not listening to his name. That's how pretty helped us figure out what was going on. Right now, he does listen to his name, he does stop, he does come when we ask him to. We still can lose him in the grocery store, shopping mall, because when we find something that's stimulating to him, usually he just walks away, he forgets we exist. It just happened last weekend. Fortunately, my wife knew what was interesting to him visually, and she found him in a different store somewhere. That's why he has a bracelet right now on his wrist, because he has his name on it. You cannot say his name under pressure. If somebody asks him, what's your name, notice his name. Again, as in California, he had a lot of services. He had speech therapy about 90 minutes a week. He had OT 10 minutes a week, physical education 10 minutes a week. He had a specialized teacher working with him. Now, what he has here is similar, except it's just a fraction of what it was there. Now, the first 2 years, he had those services and he made tons of progress. And I'm not saying that it's not good what we're getting here, it's just a fraction of it. And he wouldn't be as good as he is right now without those services. The issue I see right now with the AEI, 0 to 3 years old, is the services are a lot less than that. I think at the ECSC 3 to 5, it's a little better. And again, the IFSP is supposed to be individualized, the services put to be individualized to the kids, but when we did IFSP with him, we quickly found out that, for example, the maximum amount of minutes he could get for a speech pathologist was 20 minutes a week. That was just maximum, and if we weren't happy with that, we had the only recourse was to go to lawsuits. Now, and it's not a direction we'd like to take, so we didn't go that way. So we dealt with it, and we just took 20 minutes a week. We used to do also private therapy for speech as well. But again, his progress has been so good in the first 2.5 to the first 2 years elsewhere that we feel more content at this point and we can handle him. But if I was in a situation where it wasn't like that, I'd be in trouble right now. Because financially, locally, the clinics are about $165 an hour for speech. And I don't think we can afford that right now. That's my 3 minutes. Now, I use this timer all the time with him because he's the only way to get to move on to when he likes something. So this is a funny question. I have the IFS piece from before and now as well.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Is it Sato?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Any question?
And I don't want anyone to, if you don't ask questions or make comments, it's not because we're not interested and want to ask you 1,000 questions, it's because we want to give as many people. So we really thank you very much for coming down and thank you.
Thank you for being here.
We have one more member of the
group here. I'm sorry. I'm so focused. I'm looking at the... I apologize.
Well, I need to ask a procedural question. I had a short video that I wanted to show, and we weren't sure if it was acceptable to the chair to turn it on. It's literally a minute and a half.
Yeah, well, it would be preferable if you talked to us.
Okay.
And just for the time's sake, I really appreciate it. Thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Yes. If she would like to email the video to any of us, which we do actually occasionally receive,
I'd be happy to do it. I have it on my computer. So
okay, thank you, Senator Devlin.
That's a great suggestion.
Thank you.
My name is Gail Bowser. I am we're here representing the Southern Oregon AIECSC program from Douglas County and Jackson County and Josephine County and Lake County and Klamath County. So you can see that we are very geographically diverse and pretty large region geographically, although our numbers match the population of some of the other regions in terms of the children we serve. The video that I brought to show you today and that I will email to you is about a child from Douglas County. And the reason we brought it to augment the kinds of things that people are talking about today is that we thought you'd like to see what you're buying with some of the EICSE dollars. This is a video that shows a child, an infant. She's 16 months old. She was born with multiple physical disabilities but no cognitive disabilities or other developmental delays. And the video shows her in a therapy session, a family session, with her mom. So what you will see when we send it to you is an occupational therapist and a physical therapist teaching Jade's mom how to work with her, how to handle her so that she's safe and comfortable, and how to just be as good a mom as possible. That addressing her child's needs. I think one of the other things that you will see in this video is the wonderful level of relationship that has been developed between these professionals and the family and the kinds of sharing that they're doing. It's, as I said, it's just a very short clip of one therapy session, but it sure just shows that kind of interaction. So I will send it to you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm not sure how we organize. Well, you'll be able to get all our email addresses. And
I think I can get it off the legislative website.
You can do it that way too. So we
can
help.
She could send it to Darren. And Darren
you can
send it
to Darren. We'll make sure we get that.
Okay, give me an email address. I'll just send it.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Can I ask also? Are you going to make the rule that no computers today because of the time? Because then I'll take that away. There was one other presentation someone wanted.
I think today we really want to just be talking, and I don't want to say no computers. You can have a computer. I just don't want to do PowerPoint when I really hear stuff. Appreciate that. Okay. At this time, I noticed one of our colleagues, Representative Paul Holvey, is in the back, and assuming you wanted to testify briefly, he's coming out of another committee, so I'm going to call him up, and then following Representative Holvey, I'm going to go now to people who traveled more than 100 miles. And so I see Pat Haley. Haley, and then also Kat Brigham. And Wendell, is it Jim?
Yes.
So the three of you will be up next. Representative Holby, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this esteemed committee. I appreciate you giving me just a couple minutes. I'm going to be real short. I just wanted to weigh in on this particular program as it comes forward in our budget. I think that this program is really such a great investment for us to make, potentially saving our educational system lots of money in terms of future resources that would have to be put forward by our school districts and ESDs. This program just gives these kids a chance at really being in the mainstream a lot more than they would be if they didn't have this program. It's to me, this is a great investment. And I am concerned a little bit about the budget, and I'm sorry I haven't been paying attention to what's going on, so maybe it's already been talked about, but I'm concerned that there's a $3 million that I think is being added to this budget, and I think, I don't know for sure, but from what I've looked at, I think that $3 million is actually $3 million short I think that $3 million is just for half of the biennium, and that there's actually another $3 million that's missing in this budget as it is, has been proposed, I think, by the co-chairs. So I hope that you have staff take a look at that a little closer and just look at that. And I'm also...
Can you just clarify, in other words, when you say being added by, I mean, what, help us out.
Well, I didn't.
Well, I was going to ask Darren, but.
Yeah, Darren.
Go ahead, Darren.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, the $3 million I believe you're speaking to is in the document that was released in the co-chair's budget. Is that what you're discussing?
That's correct.
Okay. That $3 million represents some dollars that were actually given to the emergency by the emergency board last September, and it was just inadvertently left out of the governor's budget. And so this is actually the cost, the roll-up cost for 2007-09's budget to accommodate those dollars. So it was inadvertently left out of the governor's budget. The co-chairs have added it in to accommodate that.
And I understand that, but in looking back at what was set aside for this program that was left with the e-board, I believe that $3 million just represented half of a biennium, and that there was actually should have been a total $6 million, but I may be wrong.
Senator Devlin?
Can I clarify with Mr. Hill, Mr. Chairman? When you're saying they're reflecting it, obviously the e-board action was in the current biennium, which ends this June 30th.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're looking at the cost of rolling it up, they weren't reflecting that $3 million. So when they rolled it up into their new number, they're reflecting the full biennium.
Correct.
It's
ways and means.
But the way I looked at it, it looked like to me that $3 million was actually just for half of the biennium, and there's another $3 million floating out there. And Representative Morgan may be able to help me with that. But I just hope that the committee takes a closer look at that aspect of the money that was withheld to be delivered to them as their client count became more apparent. And so I'm just saying, I think there's a $3 million missing out of that, and I just ask you to take another look at it. That's all I'm saying. I'm not a ways and means guy, so, you know.
But this is an important conversation, so Representative Morgan.
It is an important conversation, Mr. Chair, but perhaps it's one that's better had in work session where LFO can lay all of this out for us. But I've just raised it as kind of a red flag and something that we want to be sure to look very closely at. I think it is for the last three sessions the Ways and Means process has set a chunk of money as an earmarked piece of money with the emergency board to deal with the enrollment growth for this program. And that's where I think we need to kind of make sure that we're doing what we need to do here. But I think the appropriate time to address this is in work session.
Well, thank you. And I know that...
We'll be sure to clear out the room really quickly if we keep...
But I also wanted to just mention briefly also about the timing when they do the client count. I think that's also an important consideration because I think a lot of times they've been doing it in December, and I think the recommendation is to do it in March. And I from what I understand, and I think that's also an important piece. And I think that March date reflects a better average of the caseload that this program handles, and that also affects their budget. And with that, I just want to say this is a great program, and I hope you do what you can to keep it whole.
Well, thank you, Representative Holvey, for taking the time out, and really appreciate the testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Pat Haley and Kat Brigham and Wendell Jim. Is that?
Yes.
And then on deck, so to speak, are next. Following this will be Alan Bruner, John Marty Olson, and it looks like Otto. Shell, that's what I thought, but I wanted to make sure.
Okay. Hello, I'm Pat Haley from Deer Island, Oregon, but I'm here representing Multnomah ESD. And I wanted to talk to you very briefly about the hospital school program, which is funded under the Educating Children with Disabilities in Hospital Programs, which is in the House bill that we're discussing today on Section 2.3. The hospital school program served just about 1,500 children last year at six different hospital sites in four different hospitals in Portland. And even though they're all in Portland, less than 20% of the students that we served are from Multnomah County, so it really is a statewide program. And I wanted to just thank the legislature and the Department of Ed for supporting this program over the years. The concern that I had today that I wanted to bring to your attention was in House Bill 5019, the amount that's earmarked for the biennium of OSTAT 09 is $1.574 million. Currently, we're at $1.74 million, and so we're looking at a significant decrease, about 11%, 12% decrease for the next biennium. The issue is that we're seeing more kids over time, not less. And then also the Dornbecker Children's Hospital is going through a significant expansion right now, and we're looking at serving probably at least 200 more children per year just at Dornbecker in their oncology ward. So I just wanted to draw that to your attention. The materials that I prepared for you have a little bit more detailed budgetary summaries and what we might spend the dollars on and so forth. But I just wanted you to take a look at that and take a look at that number and look at my materials and see if there was something you could do to help us out. Just for your reference, there are ORS 343.261 and the OAR 581.015.0017 pretty clearly state that all students in these hospitals are to receive educational services. So it's not like we have an option of serving some and not serving others. And so if we're going to see a lot more kids, we're going to need a bit more money, not a lot. This program actually costs about $600 per student per year. So if there are any questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Bailey. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Kat Brigham. I'm a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I'm also an elected official for the tribe. I serve as the Board of Trustees Secretary, and I am a chair of the Education and Training Committee and the Nikiawe School Board that's located on our reservation. You have written testimony that's being distributed to you, and then we also have a letter from the Oregon Indian Education Association supporting the Native American Indian education specialist position that we lost in 1996. In 1996, we had a person from the Oregon Department of Education who worked with the nine tribes of Oregon. We were very successful in developing a plan that addressed academic needs for the nine tribes in the state of Oregon and Indian people in the state of Oregon. We developed a Native American, Alaska Native education plan. It's been updated, and we were very pleased when we completed this plan in 1996, and then in 1997 we lost the funding, and this person was supposed to help us implement that plan. And so we were been working with the nine tribes in the state of Oregon, with the Oregon Department of Education under Senate Bill 770 and Education Cluster to refund this position. We were very glad when Superintendent Steele put this in her budget, but we were very disappointed again when we didn't see it put in the governor's budget. So we're here to let you know that this position is very important. It helps address many things with the nine tribes in Oregon. We are, many of us, all of us are rural tribes, and we need assistance with our education. We are work at one time education was not that important. Now education is a high priority. We are working to grow our own. We want to educate our people, and we want to work with the partnerships within the, with our local school districts to address discrimination, to work on partnerships so that they learn about our culture, become of our awareness. They don't have to accept it, but it would be nice if they understood it and also knew about our history of the nine tribes in the state of Oregon. If you have any questions, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brigham.
Mr. Wendell Jim, General Manager, Education Branch for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs.
I'm also here to support this position for the Indian education position. Just a brief history. Catherine Brigham brought you up to date on the latest approval from the State Board of Education on the Indian Education Plan. This plan was created in the early 70s from a director from Washington, D.C. State of Oregon, Indian Education Association, is approximately 35 years old. The Native American communities and nine tribes have been very instrumental in creating great plans in providing direction and where we want to take our education from tribal communities. Our programs have proven records of enhancing academic readiness, self-worth of Indian children and families. Our programs are unique opportunities to enhance the native languages. For instance, at the Confederated Tribes of Morning Springs, we have three separate languages. Today, one of the languages has less than three fluent speakers still alive today. So it's a major push for our tribes, for my tribe in Warm Springs, to promote language immersion programs, to provide opportunities for this generation to learn our native languages. One of the things that we are doing right now is not only immersion of languages, but tribal values, tribal history, preservation of our cultural foods. Tribal heritages and cultures are alive and well today. What we're trying to do is we're trying to immerse and be inclusive of and combine both the formal education and the Native American education so that it would enhance our students, and so that they also will be very proud of who they are as citizens within the state of Oregon and citizens in the United States. We are very proud of the efforts that we have developed and created under the executive order and also Senate Bill 770 in partnership with Oregon Department of Education, Offices of Community Colleges, and Oregon University Systems. So I'm here to support and to stress the importance of this position to represent the nine tribes in the state of Oregon. And one last bit is, across the United States, there are efforts that are being led by Native Americans to set up programs like this within their state governments so that they support and recognize the importance of the tribes in their respective states. So, thank you. If you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to address those.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. April, are you April Campbell? Okay, because I got a note that... use the lone name on page 4, so I apologize. No, that's okay.
My name is April Campbell. I am a Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde tribal member. I work as the division manager for education out at the tribe, and am kind of here wearing two hats. One is obviously with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde and their intent to support the Indian Education Specialist position. And then also, and of course you guys have letters of support and interest, but on the behalf of the Oregon Indian Coalition of Post-Secondary Education, both of these, both of these entities are extremely honored by the thought of having the position, and there's an extreme need to continue the position, not only to support the Senate Bill 770, but also the Senate Bill 103 with the multicultural education component. And just as Wendell had said, just kind of revitalizing the culture, sharing that with the state. Currently, we have, I think there are about 13,000 Native Americans in Oregon. We have in our little rural school district, we serve 330 Native students, and it's quite a huge population. It's at times over 50% of our population in our area. Also, we have over 500 post-secondary ed students, and so we could just see this position as an extreme... is a key position for services at the state level, at the tribal level, and having a liaison to track information, to work with our government-to-government clusters, and just to support the whole, the nine tribes in Oregon.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Questions, comments? Thank you very much, Ms. Campbell, Ms. Brigham, Mr. Jim. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alan Bruner, John, Marty Olson, and Otto Schell. And then on deck we have Dana Hepner? I always forget.
Hepper.
Yeah. Carla Wade. I don't know why I'm saying Hepner. Carla Wade, and then John McCulley.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Edwards, did I miss you?
Last again, Mr. Chair. Just in reference to the previous testimony, I'd like to request copies of the policy option package submitted by the Oregon Department of Education for the representative.
We'll get that for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Bruner. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alan Bruner, and I teach science and mathematics at Colton High School. And I'm here today basically to put a face on the numbers that the Oregon Department of Education generates. I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 5019. Also here to talk a little bit about Policy Option Package 126, the Longitudinal Growth Model, and Policy Option Package 201, the Assessment of Literacy Model. And in doing so, what I'd like to do is give two very specific examples. We understand very clearly as teachers of public schools that you, representing the people of the state of Oregon, demand accountability. And you cannot be a teacher in the public sector without understanding very clearly that we as educators are asked to perform and perform at a high level, so we demand that our students do as well. But it's a big difference between saying, I believe I taught that, and I know the students learned. And that's where the role of data comes in. And so I'm really, in fact, speaking on behalf of the Department of Ed to say, here's what we do with these wonderful reports that we get. We as teachers sit down, and we as teachers pour through, and I literally have from 2004 as one of my examples, our science reports that literally line out line by line whether students achieved Certificate of Initial Mastery status in physical science, life science, and earth science. Now, we as the science department, in fact, took this data and said, how well are we doing? Are we meeting students' needs? Are we preparing them for the workforce? Are we giving them ample opportunity to demonstrate what they know? And if not, what are we going to do as a department to change? So one of the things that we wind up doing is sitting down, in fact, as a department, saying, what's our scope and sequence? What do we wind up teaching? When do we teach it? And have the students had ample opportunity to experience and work with the information prior to being assessed? That's one major reason that we rely on ODE and the incredibly valuable data they provide. And certainly with House Bill 5019, one of the major portions is to continue the flow of information from ODE in ways that are accessible, usable, and functional for us in the trenches. One other example I'd like to illustrate in my time left is what we wound up doing as a math department, because I wear a number of hats at my school. We were able to look at 8th grade benchmarks, and again I have that data here as well, to assess, again, what students had been exposed to, what students could demonstrate mastery of, and then where we needed to remediate to make sure that these students were able to perform and perform well at the SIM or Certificate of Initial Mastery level. And again, I'm proud to say that, you know, for those districts who look at data, who have the administrative support, who have the teachers, who have opportunity to examine the numbers, we do in fact have the opportunity to respond intelligently, to make wise curricular choices. But again, they are data-driven.
And again, as I said, I'm just here to applaud you as a committee to continue the funding and to continue the emphasis. One thing you'll see in policy 126 is the idea of longitudinal growth, that sometimes the numbers we have don't necessarily always give us an opportunity to see how children have learned and grown over time. So I would commend two other state models just to consider. One is from Massachusetts, one is from North Carolina. They give opportunity to tease out more differences, because the more information we have, the better we are able to prepare our students for the future. So thank you for the continued funding. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brunner. Mr. Brunner is too modest to say he's teacher of the year, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson.
My name is John Marty Olson, and I work at the Department of Education. I'm also a member of Clackamas Education Service District, and I'm here today as president of the SEIU local in the Department of Ed. One of the main reasons why I have come here is to sort of give some background and some explanations on two of our policy option packages that are before you. One is the cross-data cross-office data management package, and the Department of Education staff has, over the last several years with No Child Left Behind, been asked to put on significant amount of hats, and we have had to try to really almost overstretch ourselves, and we've had to reach out to the districts and across different departments to be able to figure out how we can continue to meet these increased demands. Many of the departments had collected data that are very similar in different ways, and we're now in the process of trying to organize it and hopefully get so that when we get request data from the district, we only do it once in one way, and we can use it in multiple purposes. In this process, we began a conversation with the school districts about what data they need, and that was really the kicking point of the KIDS project. And what we have done in phase two of the KIDS is to take a small pilot, actually a good percentage of the students of the school districts, and to determine what the school districts themselves believe they need in order to evaluate a student as they transfer from one district to the other, and we are then also looking at how that can be aggregated and used from the states. The KIDS Phase 3 project will extend this to every school district in the state. Every school district will have the same tool set and the same data elements to be able to do the comparisons, the evaluations of students, and then allow them, while they're analyzing that, to send or to together collectively present to the state what they believe their totals are. And so I believe this is going to be a great decision-making tool for us in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Doc, Representative Glazier, if you have any questions, or your committee.
Not at this time. Thank you, Mr. Olson. We appreciate it very much. Mr. Shell.
Good afternoon.
You need to work on your penmanship, Mr. Shell.
I'm here to apologize for Jennifer's penmanship. Mine is actually pretty good, and I'll take that as a lesson for future reference. My name is Otto Shell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon PTA. We have 22,000 members across the state of Oregon in many and most of your districts. We've been advocating on behalf of kids for 100 years in Oregon. They have touched on a couple of the packages that we believe make a lot of sense, so I'll focus on a couple of different phases. The whole theme of data management has become clearer and clearer to me the more time I spend time in this building and going out and talking in a grassroots way to voters. There's a lot of public perception, a lot of mythology out there that isn't factually based, but we have a hard time wrapping our hands around the facts and the data. So the more I learn about the KIDS program, the cross-office data management program, and some of these things that provide better, modern communication and coordination of data, the more they make sense to me from the parents' perspective. Some of the programs that would streamline the ability to transfer data with kids are really important, because many kids, a shocking number, and I don't have it on the top of my head, move from school to school. And I was surprised, because we live in a very middle-class neighborhood where most of the kids are pretty steady in their enrollment. But that's not true in the majority of other places. So that's the power of one of the programs. National PTA is heavily involved in No Child Left Behind, around the issues of making sure that the data that the stick that hangs over schools is data that is actually relevant to improving the way kids are educated. And that comes down to the level that we were just talking about here in the state. The growth model provides some flexibility and different data that really can measure the progress of students. And I think that that's a really powerful tool that we should all continue to try and make progress on. And I don't want to repeat what has been said. I'll put in the word for the virtual school. I have a seventh grader. The use of computers, the ability to obtain data, it is the future. It is coming faster than most of us can keep up. I noticed that the kids in his school and the kids that I encounter out in the broader community, they really rely on the internet. They rely on the ability to find things virtually. It is a barrier breaker for kids who are located in places that don't have access to big libraries. Those are the kinds of powerful things that we can do with some fairly simple investments, and I think that those are a good value for all kids in Oregon. It'll equalize bring a lot of the schools with lesser means into a real competitive mode with other schools. And the only other thing that I've heard a lot of talk about the tag coordination through ODE. I put in a strong word for that. The more I learn about the tag program, the more I find it amazing that we haven't done something about that, and I implore you to do that. That's not part of this direct opt. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we heard about that. Was that yesterday? Or
yeah.
About 41,000 tags, and you have a 0.3 FTE, and that person really does a lot of other things, too. That was, okay. I think that was information that was very useful. So, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The data that you obtain and then track with students, how much of that finds its way home to the parents?
It's a mixed bag. Some parents are very clever about finding that data, particularly if a kid has a particular need in a special area. Parents will become more sophisticated fairly quickly. The challenge is, though, that is how do you get the data. And if you have overburdened teachers or, you know, the administrators within the school, there's a lot of lag. So the transferability of data, that whole issue of kids moving around, there's slippage there. Kids arrive, the records don't catch up. The teachers don't even get the information in a timely way to make a difference for those kids. I do think there are a lot of parents who are becoming more interested and more sophisticated about that. I admit that I'm on the geeky end of the spectrum, because I would go and look at that stuff. And fortunately for me, my kid's doing great. So, but I think that, you know, the report cards come home. The district in Portland, the district cards come home. They tend to have a decent amount of information. It does require parents to take the next step and interact with the evaluator, the teacher usually. So,
Senator Devlin. Mr. Schell, I think it's good that you came here today as a representative from the PTA, because often parents are the item that's actually left out of the discussion in public education. I don't know. I guess this is just a general comment, and I might want to get your comment. I've never seen a study that's done this, but sometimes I do believe there's a direct correlation between those parents that show up for parent-teacher conferences and those students that are actually doing well or at least above their normal performance level. And nobody up here at this dais can mandate good parental behavior. That's not really possible. But what do you see in your association? I just was interested out of curiosity in terms of, is it as strong as it's ever been? Are you having problem keeping membership?
I would love to have an off-meeting conversation with you about parent involvement. We could talk a long time. Parent involvement, it's a peculiar thing in Oregon, but we're not different than a lot of states. It is frequently spoken about as a priority, and then it doesn't really get a lot of support from the broader community. It is harder now to get parent volunteers to show up because of the two-paycheck world that we've inhabited, and that's just a demographic change. I would love to tell you that you know, the 1950s PTA world still exists, but it doesn't. The many of the really driving forces of that world have moved on and become quite substantial parts of our business economy and leaders in the community. The flip is, we are experiencing a decent growth in our membership, particularly in communities that we're reaching more dads, more minority communities. I mean, these are very pleasant surprises to me, and I think they have a lot of power for doing good things with kids. And I would be happy to provide you. There's lots of studies that connect directly. Parental involvement is one of the highest indicators for kids' performance. It's a direct correlation, and it crosses all socioeconomic standards. The thing that we have to be careful about is parent involvement doesn't just mean showing up at school. It means your kid gets to school on time, he does his homework, he's dressed, he's fed. It's all those other things that go with it. And those are still happening. You know, we're fortunate in Oregon to have continued progress on academics. We still should worry about the differential between certain groups of kids, the achievement gap, that, as it's described more simply. So.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you all three very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So Dana Hepper, who I called Hepner, I guess I was thinking about the city, and Carl Wade and John McCulley. And then following this panel, I'm going to ask, is Diane Iverson here? Diane Iverson and Becky Bennett? So I'm going to have the two of you come up next, because I have a couple of panels of three, actually three panels of three that will then follow. So who is first? I think Dana, I think you're up first.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Iglesias, members of the committee. I really appreciate the time to testify today on behalf of Stanford Children regarding the Oregon Department of Education budget. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the statewide advocacy coordinator with Stanford Children and a former teacher, and I have two very difficult names. Earlier this session, Stanford Children leaders from across the state reviewed the Department of Education policy option packages that have become priorities. Now, these leaders include current teachers, retired teachers, school administrators, retired educational researchers, and lay people, so a pretty diverse group of folks took the time to read the policy option packages before you today, and were really enthusiastic about the potential for these proposals to have a direct impact on our ability to effectively educate children across the state. We are supporting policy option package number 118, the Kids Phase 3. And just to reinforce what Otto mentioned earlier, I was a teacher at a school with 60% turnover, so each year 60% of our kids were new to the building. And it often took 3+ weeks to get the file from the previous school so that we could learn what programmatic support these kids had been receiving in their previous environment. Were these kids enrolled in special ed? Did they get a specialized reading instruction, et cetera? So for the first few weeks, we were kind of on our own to figure that stuff out and not able to utilize the best practices and work that previous districts had been doing with these children. So really excited to see this kind of integration take place. Policy option package number 126, the longitudinal growth model, is incredibly exciting. We all know that this is the direction that we need to go in measuring kids' achievement. I taught a class, a third grade class of 21 students, and at the beginning of the year, I had 10 non-readers. And at the end of the year, I had those 10 kids were all reading at least a second grade level. They grew a huge amount. Every single one of them failed the third grade reading test. But did they grow? Absolutely. Should our school be viewed as a school that's not educating kids? No way. So really excited to be looking at individual students and whether they're making progress at their schools as a measure, a more effective measure of whether our schools are being effective. We're supporting policy option package number 173, the cross-office data management, for the reasons you've already heard. And then finally, policy option package 201 is the assessment literacy piece. And I also want to kind of echo Otto Schell here from the PTA that the we're getting more and more data on our kids now every day because of No Child Left Behind and because of our ability to collect data on kids because of technology. And if we're not training our teachers and educational leaders to utilize this data, we don't have any school-level knowledge of how to effectively make use of anything that we're getting. And the translating that information to parents, I taught at a school with 80% poverty, and I had 100% of my parents show up for parent-teacher conferences. I met with at least one parent for every single child. And it would be incredibly helpful for me to not just show the parents their children's test score data, but to be able to help them interpret it. And I think that's one place where that connection between the data that the school has can really translate to the parents, not only receiving the data, but having the chance to understand that data. So just want to close by saying that we're an organization of parents, teachers, community members, young and old, very diverse membership, but I think we all in Stand for Children and a lot of other organizations you're hearing from have a common goal of wanting every child to have a great education and every child to have a fair chance in life. And we really think that the things you're seeing prioritized by the Department of Education do a great job of giving our principals and teachers and parents the tools to smartly use assessment and technology to educate our children well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hepper. And let me ask you a question, if I may. On the assessment literacy, what about our schools of education that are graduating people to teach? Are they doing a decent job at fostering assessment literacy among our teaching corps?
I received my teacher license in New York State, so I can't speak directly. Therefore, I was not a highly qualified teacher. So I cannot speak directly to whether schools in Oregon are doing a good job of assessment literacy, but certainly this is a place we need to move in this direction for people who are getting their teaching licenses, for people who have their teaching licenses, for our administrators across the board, and I think this is one piece of that.
All I can remember is Carla.
Carla Wade.
Wade.
Yes, hi. Chair and members of the committee, it's my pleasure to be here to speak to you today. I'm representing SEIU, but I am a education specialist at the Oregon Department of Education, where I'm the program manager for both Title I-A, Improving Basic Programs, and for Title II-B, Enhancing Education Through Technology, so the technology education specialist. As a part of the work that I do at the department, I'm working with the Literacy Plan Work Group. I do a lot of work with monitoring all of the districts across the state for compliance with federal programs, for working with districts as they're doing their continuous improvement planning, school improvement planning, or district improvement planning. And, of course, I'm a data owner because I respond to federal mandates for data reporting. I'm here today to testify in support of the assessment literacy and cross-office data management policy option packages. As a data owner, I work with the other offices in our department to pull together data. I own a piece of the data that I have to report, but I also have to work with other offices who are collecting other parts of that data that are where they're the data owners, and so we have to share. It starts, though, with working with some of our programmers in translating the law into code, programming code that gets put into surveys that get sent out to our districts to send data back to us. This is sometimes a somewhat complicated process as people who are program specialists like me and those programmers who speak a code language are really speaking two very different languages. It takes time to put a checks and balances in place so that we're asking the right questions of districts to get the right data back. It's imperative that we really work on streamlining our processes for collecting that data from districts, because oftentimes we might have a data specialist in the district who is submitting that data back to the department, but oftentimes it's the part-time secretary at the middle school who decided she'd volunteer to do it this year because the person who did it the year before left, or it was her turn. Their understanding of programs and what's being requested in the reporting requirement may not always be the same, so it's important that we make our language as clear as possible for them so that we get accurate data back. As a person who provides technical assistance to districts across the state in school improvement efforts, I clearly see that districts and schools are using data much more routinely than they have in the past for making data-based decisions, and I think we're on a great track there. But it's important that we have user-friendly data tools that that allow us to collect good data, that we have processes in place that allow us to easily validate that data and analyze that data. Oftentimes, the analysis of data is put onto people who are learning as they go about data analysis in the department. We're getting training as we go, but it's something that we need some time and effort put into working on improving. It's important that we are working with our schools and our districts, again, in having that understanding of the data. As a parent, I attend conferences and get data on both of my daughters who are now in high school, and I often find myself translating for my husband what the data means that we get back. Not every parent has the ability to have that person right next to them that can say, well, here's what this means. And I think parents, community members, district administrators and teachers all need to have the training that allows them to best use that data for school improvement purposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wright.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John McCulley. I'm here today representing the Agriculture Cooperative Council of Oregon and the Oregon Fairs Association in speaking on behalf of the Student Leadership Development Center part of the budget. And if you remember in past sessions, when that was not included in the budget, this room was full of students who were imploring you to add that back to the budget, and gratefully you always did because of the value those programs mean to high school students in this state. This weekend in Corvallis, the Oregon FFA will have its annual convention, and I would suggest if you're looking for a way to recharge your batteries, to renew your faith in the future, you would be well served to go to LaSalle Stewart Center sometime this weekend. 2,000 high school students from all over the state will gather there. They will put on their own meeting. They conduct the entire event themselves. There are tremendous student speakers, and it's just a wonderful experience. If you can't go to Corvallis on Monday, they will invade the Capitol, so you'll have a chance to see them.
We like the word visit.
Well, I'm probably proper. I'm going to sum up, I think, this whole student leadership by, if I can remember after 40 years, the FFA model. Learning to do, doing to learn, earning to live, and living to serve. And I think that really captures what these students are about. They take what they learn in the classroom and they actually apply it in a real-life situation. And their whole goal is to develop a career and use that career to serve others. And I believe that is really the hallmark of all of these student leadership organizations, of which FFA is just one. So I want to, of course, thank the governor for including these student leadership organizations within the budget and encourage it to stay there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Morgan.
Thank you. Mr. McCulley, I'm very glad that the students are going to come to the Capitol, because I do agree with you that it is a great restorative to be able to see those young leaders doing what they do. It's definitely a strong program that we should continue to fund.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Thank you both very much. Diane Iverson and Becky Bennett. And then following that will be Maureen Casey, Brian Peterson, and Debbie Peterson.
Diane Iverson, Portland, Oregon. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee, for giving me an opportunity to speak to you. I'm here to support the governor's recommended budget on community schools. In the Department of Education's budget, there's a $500,000 allocation for community schools. And I want to thank the governor and Superintendent Castillo for their longtime support over the last few years in helping us put together that initiative in Multnomah County. I've had the opportunity over the last 30 years to spend half of it as a classroom teacher in Redmond, Oregon, and the other half in state and county government. And through that, I've learned that we as public servants do the best work that we know how to do, but we often do it in silos. And what I have learned in Multnomah County over the last 10 years is that you can indeed hold hands with the city of Portland. You can indeed hold hands with the 8 school districts from the biggest to the smallest, and you can together design a community school model that best fits the needs of the students and the families in that community. We started off in 1998 with 8. We now have 56. We have aligned our county and city resources to a total of $30 million to help students and families succeed in school, and we are doing it holding hands with city bureaucrats, county bureaucrats, and school districts, and with the parents and students in our community. Senator Devlin, a few minutes ago, talked about parent involvement. Parent involvement is one of the key factors in our community school model in Multnomah County. And what I have learned through this process, although I was trained as an educator, is that the nonprofit community who receives our funding from the city and the county has an amazing relationship with parents at risk and communities of color. And that the superintendent in Centennial came to us recently and said, if it wasn't for our Sun Community Schools, the Latino community would not feel that they had a power and a force in our school. So I urge you to take this investment in the governor's budget of $500,000 and help us move a statewide initiative around community schools. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Iverson.
Ms. Bennett.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Becky Bennett. I am a government affairs intern for the Oregon Farm Bureau, and I'm here today to support HB 5019, specifically the Section 2, Subsection 9, the funding for the Student Leadership Centers, as I already previously talked about. This is very important to the members of the Oregon Farm Bureau and to agriculturalists as a whole. These leadership centers go beyond the classroom and teach high school students the importance of practical career skills. These students are given the tools to excel in school as well as get a jump start in college or the workforce. This funding is vital for these organizations to stay afloat from the ever-increasing school budget cuts. Many of these programs are the first to be cut because they are not required within the curriculum. As a past member of the Wilhelmina FFA chapter and a current member of the Oregon State FFA chapter, I personally understand the vitality of these organizations. I competed in public speaking, parliamentary procedure, and dozens of other career building skills and competitions, none of which were taught in my regular curriculum. These were all outside of the classroom, competing in different events. The classes I took with my ag teacher not only included taking care of pigs and sheep, but it also included how to run a business, how to weld, how to graft trees, and then also the researching aspect. This wide array of knowledge appeals to everyone, not just agriculture-influenced students. Because of my involvement with the FFA program, I was able to receive both my CIM and my CAM, Certificate of Advanced Mastery, through the FFA program. And all three of the students that actually got our CAM was through the FFA programs. So that was a big achievement. Without the help of the FFA organization, I would not be the person I am here today speaking in front of you. This organization was able to jumpstart me and has allowed me to influence my decision in college and where I'm going to for the rest of my life. So I would urge you, please send this to the folder at Ways and Means Committee so that this can get passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bennett. Any questions? So I missed it. Did you say you are in college?
Yes, I am in college. I'm a senior right now at Oregon State University.
Fantastic. Well, very articulate. Obviously, the training
was very useful. I'd left some pointers if you could help us out on both parliamentary procedure and public speaking. We have extra time, so thank you very much for coming, Ms. Iverson. All right, now I have three panels with the same handwriting. Where did he go? I can't see him anymore. So we have no time left, but I think it's better to just, if maybe I will be here. So I have Maureen Casey, Brian Peterson, Debbie Peterson, and then
Larvik.
Pardon me?
Larvik. You know what? How about
you should all come up.
The students.
Yeah, I mean, it just
great.
Yes, whatever you think will work best, because I understand it looks like you're all together, so time is short.
Chair Glazier, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Maureen Casey, and I'm the superintendent of the Laman Education Service District. And the part of the regional testimony today is to give you an understanding of the programs and the services that are provided through low-incidence regional programs and also early intervention, early childhood, special ed. So really, we're going to do that by allowing stories to give you kind of a panoramic view from the student's point of view, the teacher's point of view, the parent's point of view, and some specialists. And it's their story that really tells and gives you the real picture. But to begin with, we're just going to take a minute so you have the frame of reference to put this in. And if you'll look at, we're passing around, there's a stack of about 70 letters that have come in from every single one of your regions across the state, from parents, from advocates, from schools, all encouraging you to support the regional program budget in that we'll be asking for in just a minute. But if you look at that map, I wanted to let you know that currently the State Department of Education contracts with 7 education service districts and Portland Public Schools, that would be Columbia Regional Program, to provide these services to all of the school districts in those regions and also the early childhood programs. The legislature, your esteemed peers, came up with this model in 1983 because it was very efficient. And if you look at the yellow page, it lists the reasons why. Not only from a cost efficiency model, but it's an equity issue. So that students with low incident, high need disabilities, and we're talking about students who are deaf and hard of hearing, students who are blind and visually impaired, students who have autism spectrum disorder, and students who are severely orthopedically impaired, that those students could attend programs in their home schools, their local communities, and have access to support services. Right now, as of December, the program is serving approximately 8,000 children from birth through 21, and it's a cost-effective model not only from a monetary point of view, but we're talking about a resource point of view, personnel resource. You've teachers of the hearing impaired and visually impaired, physical therapists, autism specialists, brailleists. You've all heard of personnel shortages. These professionals are on the endangered species list. There is a state and national shortage. They are very difficult to recruit. These regional programs in front of you recruit these staff nationwide, and then they serve districts and early childhood programs. They cross over districts. They cross over county boundaries. So you get the impact of really an economy of scale efficiency. So what's the issue? The issue before us is that the Oregon Department of Education submitted a policy option package to the governor's office for an increase due to caseload growth. The student population has grown 36% since 2003. It's a 12% increase last year. The policy option package was not included in the governor's budget. So the current service level cannot be maintained with a 1.5% increase. That won't cover roll-up costs, let alone student growth. So the problem is so serious that it actually jeopardizes a model, a true proven model that's effective and efficient. If there were no regional programs and every school district in the state had to provide these services, it would increase the cost astronomically, and you'd run the risk of not being able to find these highly specialized professionals. So what are the outcomes? You have a list in front of you. I'm not going to read it. You'll have more information from the State Department on Monday, but we'd like you to support an increase in that regional program budget in the grant and aid presentation, and we'd like the students and the parents to share the outcomes with you so you have something besides the paper. So currently, there are 1,252 students who are deaf and hard of hearing who receive regional services, and Brian has volunteered to be here today and share his story with you. Brian, you're next.
Hi, my name is Brian, Brian Peterson, and I'm from Grover Elementary. I'm 11 and I'm in fifth grade, and I really appreciate what I have. I'm able to go and have opportunities at school and be with other kids that are deaf and hearing. And I get really good interpreters at my school, and I have good teachers, and I have teachers who know how to sign, and so I can talk to them.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Debbie Peterson. I'm the proud mother of Brian. I appreciate that Brian is in a community in which he can interface, and he has done very well. He has a team of people that he can draw from that know these kids. They know their strengths, their weaknesses, and that understand their cultural issues of their situations. Because of Northwest Regional Education Service District, Brian has great potential to reach his success. He is a leader of the future, and Northwest Regional Education Service District has played a large part in that.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Beckin. I'm a special programs director with Hillsborough School District 1J, and I thank you for allowing me to come here to speak with you about the critical need for adequate funding for low-incidence regional programs. Among my other duties, I oversee our district programs for students with moderate to severe disabilities. These are the students whose education programs are extremely service-intensive and often include highly specialized direct services by regional staff. Additionally, our district staff working with these students need thorough and ongoing training given by regional staff to be able to work effectively with and deliver appropriate educational services for these students. As an administrator striving to provide excellence in education for all Oregon students, I am very aware of the needs of this low-incidence group. Previous to my current role, I had the privilege to serve as a regional specialist for students with autism spectrum disorder. I saw the need across the state. Parents, teachers, and school leaders are eager for more training and more services for their low-incidence students. Like much of our state, Hillsborough has been a growing district for many years. Since 2002, our general student population has grown by 5.5%. During the same five-year period, our population of students with special needs, those students who are eligible for services under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or the IDEA, has grown by more than 6.5%. In just the last year, Hillsborough's general population grew by 1.65%, but our special populations grew by 2%. This accelerated trend in special populations is mirrored within special ed itself. In 5 years ago, the total percentage of our low-incidence regional students was 9.8% of all of our special needs students. This past year, that total is 11.6%. Last year, let's see, I looked it up. I wanted to have my data here. We actually are growing these complex service-intensive students are growing at a faster rate than our general population. the need for specialized services, including huge staff training resources for this, for instance, for the students with autism spectrum disorder alone, is staggering. We gained a full percentage point in the last year of students who are regionally eligible, and that was wholly attributable to students with autism spectrum disorder. The information that we have received about the federal IDEA funding for the next biennium is not encouraging. The projected increase will not cover district roll-up costs for the coming year. House Bill 5019's appropriation for regional programs further erodes funding and requires districts to try to fill the gap to maintain highly specialized and intensive services for these most complex students. I urge you to consider the makeup of our special needs populations and the increasing complexity of the needs of the students that we are serving, and to appropriate funds sufficient to maintain good programs for great kids.
Thank you very much. I have a question for Brian. Brian, are you in fifth grade?
Yes.
Your favorite class?
Or subject?
I think I like reading and writing class best. I like my English class.
And what about outside of school? What do you like to do outside of school?
I don't know. Like sometimes we go to... You mean like visiting in Eastern Oregon? I like to do that.
Sure. Is this your idea of fun, what we're doing here today?
It's all right, I think.
Well, we're glad you're here.
I'm learning a lot. I learned about government this year, so I learned a lot.
Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Are we two more students? Okay.
For students, yes.
Only students at this point.
Start?
Well, absolutely. You just say your name. And
right. My name is Zachary Carter. I'm in
Can you speak up a little?
I'm a ninth. My name is Zach Carter. I'm a ninth grade student attending Sheldon High School. For my classes, I have geography, health, math, and for a hobby after school, I like to go bow shooting, and I use a monocular, which it's kind of like a binocular, but it only has one eyepiece, and it helps me see where I hit the target and stuff. And I receive vision services because I have some missing iris in my eye and retinal tissue, and I am at risk at further vision loss, and but I can see well enough for large print. And I work with my vision teacher to get my textbooks in large print and on CD. The CD player that I have for books and stuff, it jumps from pages to pages and chapters, so I don't spend all the time looking for stuff in the book. And another piece of technology I have is magnifiers, so I can see it better, and a book stand, so I can see it better, brings my work closer to me. And also, my vision teacher helps my teachers do large print and stuff, so they know how to use the copier and stuff, because some don't know that kind of knowledge, and are teachers, so...
Well, sometimes you have to teach the teachers what to do.
Yeah, it's the teacher. And the services I get from my regional program are very important to me because of my risk of my retinal detachment.
I need to work on Braille, and my vision teacher works with my teachers for like adaptions for me. Like I have to sit up front and stuff. They make sure that happens. And an example is, I'm in a technology class, and I couldn't see the screen very well on the computer, so he helped the teacher change the settings so I could see it better. And I work with my vision teacher twice a month, and I have an independent study for Braille. And with my vision teacher, I learned how to use the CD player for the books and stuff, and how to do large print and computer accessibility. And from my social activities throughout, through the Lane Regional Program, we are able to participate in GoBall, a museum trip, and a breakfast book club. And GoBall is where you have two people on the, like, you have three people on one end of the basketball gym, and you have three people on the other side, and they're blindfolded, and you throw a ball, roll it down, and you try and make a goal. That's fun. In World Breakfast Book Club, we have a student pick out a restaurant, and we get to have Braille menus so we can practice and stuff. And we just eat breakfast and stuff. And in school, I'm doing well, and with my services, I succeed well in school, and my goal is to go to college. Thank you.
Thank you. Zach?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. So when you said bow shooting?
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't bring any of that equipment today, did you?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Zach.
Hello.
Hello.
My name is Megan Smith, and I'm a junior at Sheldon High School. When I was about four, my family wanted to move from California, and they were recommended to move here, to Oregon. And one of the main reasons they chose this state is because of its excellent vision services. So not only is Oregon known within itself for great services for visually impaired students, but also known across state lines for this. When I came here, my parents really wanted me to be a mainstream student, to be able to go into my home school and be with other kids. And that was great, but I didn't know very many blind students as well, who were going through my same circumstances and had my same disability. So I started attending what Zach mentioned before is the Braille Breakfast Book Club, which not only gave us the opportunity to practice Braille, practice ordering, practice paying for our own food and folding our bills the right way, but also gave us the opportunity to socialize with other people in our same circumstance. Some of the other extracurricular activities I've taken on over the years have been, I started this year leading a women's a cappella choir. I also swim for my high school at Sheldon Irish, and I have taken that a little bit further even, and I went to the Para Can-Am Championships last week and did really well there. So I'm a very well-rounded student as far as extracurricular activities go. As far as my academics, I am in the Honors English program and history. I've taken physics and geometry and also algebra. These academic classes are extremely hard even when you can see, but when you can't, it makes it a lot harder. But fortunately, we have lots of technology to make it easier for blind students to learn. Like, I have the audio graphing calculator for my algebra, which is basically a graphing calculator that has an audio feedback that tells me what the graph looks like. I have a CD player like Zach for some of my textbooks, and I also use Braille textbooks. I also have a computer with speech capabilities that allows me to use the internet and research and email and communicate with people, because that's really important to me as well. I also use a Braille note, which is what I'm using to keep track of where I am in the speech and not ramble on and on. It has speech capabilities, it also has a braille display, internet capabilities, and it also has a portable GPS system that comes with it that helps with my mobility and knowing where things are. As well as that GPS system, which does help, what is also important is the fact that I get a lot of mobility hours. In elementary school, I worked with a mobility instructor every day after school. Now I don't do that. I work with them twice a week because I'm getting more independent. But having a lot of mobility training has given me the ability to be independent and very successful, and I've attended the Summer Work Experience Program for visually impaired students, which allows us to ride the bus, take public transit, keep a job, get to the job on our own, shop on our own, and be very independent. So that, and independence is extremely important to me. When my parents moved here, they knew that the services were going to be great because they had been recommended. It is my hope for future students that they can be as successful as I have been. And I can honestly say that without the services that I've received, I would not be the student or the person I am today. So my hope for the future is that these services can be maintained and that students of the future can have the opportunity to succeed in school as well as in life.
Megan, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
When do you find time to sleep?
I don't.
Okay. That's your secret.
Weekends.
And,
I crash.
Do you any idea about college, particular plans, or?
I don't know exactly where I'm going to go. What I would like to do is study music.
Oh.
And also continue my swimming because I hope to go to Beijing in 2008 for the Paralympics.
2008, would it be in the summer or?
Yeah, the summer Olympics, they have a Paralympics, which is for disabilities.
Right.
It's for people with physical disabilities to do
and,
Olympics as well.
And freestyle, I mean, what's your specialty in swimming?
Probably distance freestyle, 400 free.
Great, that's fantastic.
So,
well, I think on behalf of the committee, I wanted to say thank you. You're obviously both very successful, and we really appreciate you taking the time out of your obviously busy lives to come down here. It's very important that you do this, and we really appreciate you spending the time and also looking out for friends and colleagues and people who need and use these services now and in the future. So we really appreciate that, and thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Oh, Senator Morse.
Well, thank you. Is the public testimony concluded?
Yes, I think we're... Yes.
Okay, well, thank you. I would like to suggest that staff flag the issue that's been raised with respect to the funding for low-income disabilities, the regional programs. If that population as presented is 7,900 children, and if the actual appropriation is 844 less per student than it was in this plan, and that's about $6.7 million. And I would like to make sure we flag that and bring that back in the broad discussion, because that's a, seems to me that's a major program. So we understand better how that number was arrived at in the budget.
Right. No, I think
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to do that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Good comments.
Yes, thank you. Again, thank you all very much. With that, I'm going to close the public testimony on 5019 and close the hearing. We're adjourned. Thanks for coming.